Good afternoon. I hope you all enjoyed your spring break. Usually when I teach on campus, I have whoever had the best tan have a little contest, whoever got the best tan. It doesn't look like many of you went and did the trip. But if you're an undergraduate going to Florida or California or Texas, wherever it is, one of the goals is to get as deep a tan as you possibly can, assuming you don't have a natural tan. If you do, then it's not such a big deal. And usually a couple people come back looking like they spent the whole holiday in a microwave. But yeah, you look like you avoided that particular danger. There's only one thing worse than an undergraduate trying to get the ultimate tan. And that's you find yourself in Orlando with an extra day. And you decide you're going to visit Disney World in one day. Has anybody ever tried that? It's as close to killing yourself legally as it's possible to do. But I mean, anyway, that's another story. So as people ask, the first thing I'll be doing today is handing back the homeworks. Some of you already got it. I had them in office hours, and some people did that. I also have an answer key. And Learn at UW has some stats, and I thought I'd just put mine down there to make it clear. A couple of people did very well indeed, 94, which is essentially on a basis of 100, which is very high. One person did not so well, and it's 39. The median, that is how many people above you versus below you, was 71, and you can see the distribution. I think the bulk of the grades were, in fact, in the 70s. And I'll explain, I'm going to go through some of the answers, particularly the ones that cause people problems, and maybe I'll short-circuit some questions about grading. But first, let me just hand things back. I also have a copy of the answer key. For some crazy reason, it came out rotated, but it's readable, and I didn't want to waste the paper, so we'll make do with that. So Junaid Beganawa, or Wawa? Jonathan Block. Matt Brofsky. Oh, good. I thought I was in the wrong class. I didn't grab one of these. Eric Boyd. And we made one of these. Ted Brenner. Carl Carlson. It's the first time since the 1970s I saw diagrams like that. See, I think they're mostly stapled together, so it doesn't much matter. As you can see, he had such a great solution that it kind of bowled me over. So, Chris Viernig, it had been in order. It's no longer in order. Blaise Norton Wissala. Ted Pick. I'm sorry, Terry. No, Trey. We'll get it. Trey Pick. Sure. Elisier Posner. Dave Whalen. Dan Wilmer. Zun Zhao with a Z. Rob Owen. Nicholas Moloch. Dan Yogerst, your handwriting is as bad as mine, almost. Catherine Pracknow. Carson Quinlan. Patrick Robichaud. Sure. Michael Santana. Ryan Smith. Emma Schultz. Derek Thompson. Joel Thompson. Luke Matthews. Mason Mandan. James Mezuszewski. Tim Lohr. John Liu, L-I-U. Ann Litersky, Litersky. Stephen Lampier. Ali Kator, I think it is. Eric Kleinberg. Suzanne Kelly. Grant Gentoff Johnson. Sure. Mike Hudson, but not like the river. Stuart Isaac. Jacob Harper. Eric Gross. Mr. G, G-E. Dan Gerber. Brandon Frank. Ben Fleming. Tim Fairreason. Lorian Drager. Sam Felt. Josh Chancellard, and last but not least, Ryan Kalipi. Two Ryans? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You were the very first one, in fact, as you... I had it roughly alphabetized once upon a time. That's why you missed it. No. Yeah. This one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll keep these others for people who didn't make it or came in late. So the takeaways on these are that the purpose of this homework was really to get you ready for the exam, which is either tomorrow or a week from tomorrow. And I'll go over some of the issues in this homework. And then what I'll do is, in preparation for the exam tomorrow or a week from tomorrow, I'll just open the floor to questions about old exams or please re-explain this issue or that or whatever. And that'll take as long as it takes today. And then we'll finish the day with regular lectures. I've been looking at the grades so far, and I think people are doing pretty well. You are hard judges of yourself because you have such strong colleagues. But I talked to the folks over at the university about the program, and I believe the rule is if you get a BC or better in the course, then the company will pay your tuition, which is a big issue. And what I'm seeing now, virtually everybody, if not everybody, is on track to get at least that, and certainly some better. So what you want to do is keep handing in projects and make sure that you don't force me to give you a zero on anything. But failing that, some people will get A's, some will not get A's, but I don't think it's anywhere spot where you'll get to spend your money instead of Judy's money. And that's one of my goals is, you know, and sometimes, you know, I'm always thinking of myself as a capitalist, but it's always a situation there that if you see somebody with more than enough and someone with perhaps less than enough, it's always a temptation. Yeah. Oh, no, it can't be.
No.
No, I checked. I checked with my liaison. He said BC. If somebody definitely knows, please tell me. But consensus is a BC? Yeah. The way it works at the university, if you're unfamiliar with it, is they don't have pluses and minuses. They have this sort of intermediate. So a BC is halfway between a B and a C. And I think that's probably fair. A B, depending on how tough the grader is a pretty strong grade. A C is a bare pass, so a B, C would be you did better than bare pass. And I think in terms of learning what you should have learned and it being advantageous to the company to have you take the course, I think that's fair. I'll double check that if you want, or If you know the person to check it with, you know, do it for me and let me know if the answer is other than what I believe it is.
I think it's BC for reimbursement, but it's a B, like B or better for the ASC credit.
Oh, that's it. That's it. Okay. Oh, sitting through my class twice, wouldn't that be torture? Oh, my God. It's like an old Twilight Zone where some Nazi captain who sunk a ship full of passengers has to relive the terror night after night. And so you're welcome to the Twilight Zone. Oh, I can't even spell. Let me get my little pen. So let me go over this and then we'll... That's a midterm. So the first midterm is tomorrow in this room, 5:30 to 7:30. Can I just get a rough show of hands of who's expecting to come, just so I know how many exam copies to make? Fewer than half, right? I think between 12 and 15, so I'll make a few extra. Again, you can change your mind either way. It's a situation there that it's always kind of situation they push it back. And a story is, you know, April 15th is coming up, and usually when I mention that to my class, I have vacant looks. April 15th, what's that? But I bet you folks know what April 15th is, and you always wonder, why is it April 15th and not January 1st, for example? Does anybody know the answer? The answer is it used to be, and everybody says, oh, I can't get it in. Give me extra time, and it got pushed. And now it's April 15th. So I'll make a note of about 15, perhaps. Okay. Also, the question of what's being covered. What will be covered is everything through and including parsing and grammars. That is Project 3, but nothing beyond it. So the stuff I've been talking about last lecture and talk about this lecture with respect to type checking and code generation after that will all be on the final. And the final is non-cumulative, so after you take tomorrow's or a week from tomorrow's exam, the first half of the class is closed with respect to examination. Presumably you've programmed what you're going to program and you've tested on what you need to test, and we'll just then do the end of the class. It's also the case that I had some good news last couple of days, namely a couple of you have been accepted to the professional master's program, at least two, maybe more. Now that, as I understand it, is a situation where people hold their jobs, so you'll continue working here, and we also have a couple who are in professional master's but not EPIC employees, but go out to campus and take regular master's level courses, probably one a semester, until you accumulate the right number of credits and you then get a regular master's degree. So from your point of view, you get to keep the job. From the university's point of view, they love you, by the way, is that they don't have to give you teaching assistantships or research assistantships. So usually what happens is when you're a graduate student, you're in a happy situation. They pay you to go to school. Usually you have to do some work, research or teaching, grading, something like that. But when I found out about that, that was cool. I thought, like, pay me to go to school, you know, that's great. But professional masters from the university are even better because presumably EPIC or your other companies will pay, or maybe you'll pay out of your pocket. I hope not, but maybe. And the university gets the same kind of tuition, but far less payout on their end. So they love you. So anyway, the reason I mention that is perhaps at one of the breaks, the people who've been accepted, I know at least two and maybe more, and the people currently in the program might want to come and just come down there and meet each other, because now you're going to have sort of a common set of goals. It could be the case, you know, that when you have classes, you drive out to campus together, or, you know, just plot about what courses you might want to take, which are most interesting or relevant. There's a ton of courses out there, and many of them are really very interesting and very relevant. We're getting into human-computer interaction, natural language processing, robotics, mobile networking, mobile computing in general, very large databases, and certainly databases are near and dear to the heart. I'm here. Big computing, I think, is something we're starting to get into, where big means, you know, not just megabytes, not just gigabytes, but terabytes, or what is it, petabytes, and on in a situation. So we had, I think, at least one person who has access to Twitter feed and talk about cool things there. And apparently companies are starting to harness this so that, for example, if a disaster happens, sometimes the first way you find out about it is through Twitter feeds. Even before it goes on to the wires and all that or something like that. And if you're a company, you say, You know, your BP, when they had that big blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. Just imagine if you were a big holder of BP and you said, oh my gosh, BP is just gushing millions of gallons or how many it is into the Gulf. That can't be a good thing if you're a stockholder. Dump the shares and people get out early, I think, made money. I think BP did lose money. Certainly, you know, the government taxed the heck out of them as punishment. So at any rate, lots of interesting stuff going on. There's also, I will announce this more detailed, but there's an annual EPIC computer science picnic, which now you're allowed to attend in both hats. That's going to be, I believe it's tended to be in the first week of May, probably a Thursday. It's not definite, but it's pretty close. So you're all welcome to that. And particular, if you want to meet a particular faculty member and talk to he or she about a course or what they're doing, I don't know for sure who's going to be coming, but when faculty hear about free food and free good food, they tend to show up too. And a lot of them want to see your, are the new buildings going to be open by the beginning of May, the ones? Oh, cool. So that'd be a great thing to come out there and see the inside of that situation there. Maybe, you know, some of you, it isn't one of my Harry Potter buildings, so you can get the, you know, to get the wand and Excelsior or something and turn them into a toad or a newt or whatever suits your fancy. So anyway, that will be there, and I'll make another announcement of that. By all means, attend, meet your fellow students or meet faculty. Another thing I'm planning to do, and I'm not sure exactly when, is have the person who will be teaching the next course in sequence come out and make a presentation during my class for a short period so you can meet that person and find out about the course. Now, has that been officially announced yet? I believe it's going to be done over the summer. And I'll let him talk about it. But, you know, that he's, I know the fellow who's next in line, and he's open and eager, I guess, to come and make his presentation to let you know what you're getting into before you're signed up and it's too late. So, okay, let's go and let me talk about, since you have an answer key, I just want to get the highlights of, and this should just be a projection of what you already have copied. So it's one of these sort of oddities that I've taught this course before, and something like a slash star, star slash comment conceptually seems pretty easy. And yet, every time I ask this question, it seems a substantial fraction of the class, including this class, I would say at least half and probably more, got the thing wrong. And it's one of these things, I guess, that sometimes it's like an optical delusion where, you know, you think you see something and it just isn't what you see. So at any rate, if you saw number one and I gave you typically 10 out of 20, and I have a comment that says gens and a star and another comment that says gens and a slash, what that is saying is if you take that part and the other part of your solution, kind of like what has here, you can generate a star from one of them and a slash from the other. Put them together in the wrong way, and you get a star slash too soon, and that's an error. So here's an example where something like that might happen. And this is not dissimilar to what many of you did, maybe not identical. So you're thinking up here, I won't put down a star, and then I will put down a star, but I won't put down a slash, and that'll do it. But this would get that comment I just talked about, because not a slash includes a star. Not a star includes a slash. So if I use this one, I get a star. Use that one, I get a slash. There's an OR bar and a star iterator. So that's a failure. It wouldn't work. Interestingly enough, a number of you did that regular expression tester and tested your expressions, and you didn't realize when the thing was not working. Because what would happen with the tester is if you had slash star, star slash, star slash, it would accept it. And that means it gave you no error message. But it should have, because that was wrong. The rule was you can't have a star slash in the body of the comment. And again, the question is why? Well, notice if you could have one of those, you could have more than one comment eaten by one match. And what's worse, the stuff in between, which is non-comment, would be consumed and thrown away, but you'd never necessarily know it. You'd get no error messages because it wasn't processed, and you'd be compiling a program other than what you thought you had. So it is really a serious error. So many of you had something similar to this. A closer solution is this sort of thing where I put down a star and then I don't put down a star slash. The trouble with this one is that it doesn't allow a common comment form where you have slash star, star slash, and the entire text of the comment is stars. People do that occasionally. They draw kind of like a box around their comment. And you have to change slightly so that if you want extra stars, you generate it here. So if you wanted something that was all stars, you'd let the body here generate nothing and just let the closing star be replicated as many times as you want. And that would give you slash star, run as many stars as you want, and then star slash. So one big gotcha and one small gotcha. And I know I warn people, you know, that it's a little tricky, but it always seems that people still get hammered with it. So at any rate, that explains my grading and just if you got trapped by it, don't feel too bad. Again, it's one of those things that people just fall into the trap and you kind of have to realize that something bad can happen beforehand. Question number two, people did pretty well on. And I just wanted to mention there were two solutions on that. Many of you did the alternative solution. That's okay. I didn't take off points, so you're not going to grouse about it. But the solution I had in mind was one where I simply count the number of A's and B's I've seen with a number two always being the maximum I ever count, and therefore the thing stays finite. So my counters here might mean 2, 0 means I've seen 2 A's and 0 B's. And you can understand that, and once you understand the intent, it's pretty reasonable. But it happened that other people, many of you, came out with a very clever and good alternative solution. And you said to yourself, well, the basics is you got to have 2 A's and 2 B's. And there's only 4 ways I can do that. I can have a couple of A's. What these would represent is the relative order in which I see the first 2 A's and the first 2 B's. So this would say I can see 2 A's first and 2 B's. Now, that's not the complete answer. Or I can see A, B, A, B, or B, A, B, A, or B, B, A, A. Those are the 4 essential ways you can see the first 2 A's and first 2 B's. And then all you do is say, well, after I've seen 2 A's, I can generate additional A's, so I can put what amounts to an A star. I'm doing it as regular expression, but I could also do, of course, as an automaton. Down here, it's a situation after I see the 2 A's and the 2 B's, you see additional A or B's. Here you see an A, B, A, B, and after that you can see additional A or B's. A or B's. And here you can see additional B's. And you drew it mostly as automata, but it's a very clever idea and perfectly good. So I just wanted to point that out as oftentimes there's more than one good way to solve a problem. And in this case, that was a good alternative. Number 3 was just essentially run the algorithm sort of thing. And generally people did well here, except for some reason, I don't know if I misphrased the question, a lot of people showed me not 3 partial solutions, but 2. Normally, I said, first show me the non-deterministic, then make it deterministic, then optimize it. And a lot of cases, people left the number 2, the middle part, out. So I took some points for that. Also the case for the original non-deterministic automata, people came up with some really interesting, read that as complex, automata. They were right. And a couple of cases I put down there, how in the world did you ever get that from the original definition? I didn't take off points because it wasn't wrong. It was just way more complex than I would have ever imagined somebody would create. So just one of those things. If you saw that comment, I said, my gosh, you know, you must have got a brainstorm or something. But other than that, people did pretty well. Question number 4, a number of people got trapped on that. This is the one about give me binary numbers that are evenly divisible by 3. Now, a number of people says, well, I looked at it, the pattern looks pretty complex, so I'm pretty sure it doesn't exist. I can understand the temptation, but that's not good science, that's not good mathematics. Nobody ever wins a Nobel Prize for saying, well, I thought about the problem a long time, and I'm a pretty smart person, and I don't see an answer, so it must be absolutely impossible. I have the temptation myself, but that's not good science, and it's not good mathematics. So I wanted to show you essentially the, quote, trick that I had in mind. And I warned you in advance that you wouldn't be able to do the solution if you had to read all the digits first and do the analysis later. To make this thing work, if it was going to work at all, it would have to be incremental, where you read a prefix of a number, conclude something about it, and then extend that by one more digit, either a 0 or a 1, to get a new result, and keep doing that until you've read all the digits. And in fact, the trick was, you remember one of three things. And in the automata, I have them as these triple equals. And that's sort of mathematic ease, as I remember, that says the remainder is. So I had three states, one remainder zero, remainder one, and remainder two. And the thing about this was that if you know the remainder of a prefix, so if I know the remainder of a long prefix, I don't care if it's one digit, two digits, as many, and I know either the remainder is equal to zero, or remainder is equal to one, or the remainder is equal to two, I'm able to read one more digit on the right, because remember, I'm reading left to right, which is the conventional way we scan, and get information about the new remainder. I never have the whole number in my memory when I do the calculation, which is why it's doable. So for example, the way we do this is, and see, oops, sorry about that, I always do that. So you say, if for example, I have a number like this, and I add a zero to its right. Well, when you add another digit, that's essentially the same as multiplying by two. Why? Because it's base two. The same thing is when you have a decimal number and you shift it over one position, it multiplies it by 10. So 100, you add another digit, you're into the thousands, and then the 10,000s, and then the 100,000s. So if I have a remainder of zero and I multiply it by two, what's the new remainder? It's zero. And if I add in a zero, that is, I take this thing and I plug in a zero, if my original remainder was zero, my new remainder is still zero. That's illustrated by the fact that in this state, zero loops on itself. If I get a one, well, I multiply by two, the remainder was zero, and I added in a one, so now the remainder, of course, must be one, because the new number is one bigger than the previous number. So in this case, if I see a zero and I read a one, I go to the state that says my remainder was one. Similarly, if I have a 1 and I read in another digit, that's the same thing as multiplying by 2. So if I take a 1 and multiply by 2, a remainder of 1, multiply by 2, the remainder is 2. If I see a 0, then the remainder is 2. So in this case, 1 and I see a 0, the remainder becomes 2. If I see a 1, the remainder was 2, I added 1 in, that's 3. But of course, I'm dividing by 3, so that takes me back to 0. So in that particular case, going from 1 and I see a 1, I go back to 0. The final case is a 2 remainder. If I add another digit, I first multiply by 2. The remainder is 2. 2 times 2 is 4, but we're doing division by 3, so the remainder becomes 1. So if my remainder was 2 and I add in a 0, it goes to 1. And there you see the transition backwards. And if it was 2, multiply by 2, so it's 4, the remainder is 1, add in a 1, and that becomes 2. So in that particular case, I loop on 1 back to 2. And that's all you need to do. So it's a remarkably simple automaton, and the logic, once you see it, is pretty easy. So the takeaway there is, even though the pattern is complex, and it is possible to take this automaton and extract an expression. A number of you did it, either played by hand, or maybe you did some other trick. I guess some mathematician types here, there was some result that something about counting the number of ones in the whole digit. Who had that one? A couple of people had that. What was it? Count the number of ones, and then what do you do? Okay, and that was and if you knew that one, cool, and you implemented it, that was a fine solution too. This one I think is a little easier for someone who's not as advanced mathematically to appreciate. So that was 4, and on number 5, boy, did I see solutions for that. And this is relevant because there are related questions on old exams. So first let me go over the one we had, and then talk about a couple of ways you can extend that to related ideas. So the notion here is, I give you something that's regular. Now, what some of you did is you said, well, I'll take this as an example. Well, that doesn't work at all. I mean, a situation there that if you want to take how to take the 17th root of a number. We say, okay, I'll take 1. Think. What's the 17th root of 1? 1. 1 times 1 times 1 times 1 to the 17th is 1. Hey, I got it. I know how to take the 17th root of a number. But of course you don't. You just chose such a simple example that it fell into your lap. So you can't just take an ultra-simple regular expression or automaton. I I prefer automata because I think they're simpler in terms of having fewer components to worry about. So in this case, I drew one out, but this thing is not anything special except to illustrate it's got final states, not final states, loops, arrows, etc. And the trick was, remember, I had to change the regular expression to one that accepted exactly the same as the original, except the first character is deleted. So two tricks I have to enforce. One is I have to skip a character. How do I do that? Well, I take the original automaton and I put it in this dashed box, which you can barely read, I think it's there, and I put a brand new start state and have a lambda transition that goes not to the old start state, but to all those states that are one character after it. So I look at the original state, which is number one, and say, what states could I get to if I read one character? Notice I'm not even bothering label these. I don't really care what the character is, just I have to count there's a character. So I can get to two or I can get to three. So the new start state jumps directly to two or three and then resumes scanning as per normal. So clearly it skipped a character. That's one portion of delete of R. But after that, it works exactly like R did. Some of you had the issue where you simply say, I'll take the original start state and throw it away. And on many of those, and many of you made that error, you got partial credit if you did, I said, what about cycles? Notice what would hammer you is if you, in this case, I have a start state that's useless. I can throw it away, but why? I'm not asking for optimal, I'm simply saying, give me one that works. If I had an arrow that went, say, from 5 back to 1, and I pulled that state 1 out, or alternatively, many people said, make the transition from 1 to 2 or 1 to 3 lambda, then I'm in trouble. Because when I loop back, I'm going to lose not just one character, but one character per iteration, which is not what the definition said. But because I didn't change the original automaton, once I effectively advanced the start state from the original start state to one state beyond it, having read one character, all the rest has to act exactly as before. So in that case, it's clear, I think once you appreciate the construction, that it works. So I took an automaton, but this is just an automaton. It's not deterministic, doesn't matter. If you want to make it deterministic, run the algorithm and you can do it. So this is clearly an automaton that matches R except for the first character and a character it deletes. So the point of this is that there are many variations. I don't know if the exams that I showed you had it, but there's a symmetric issue. It says, let's do a delete not at the left, but at the right. That is, let's accept everything up to, but not including the very last character. Notice you can do something very similar to this construction for that guy. So that one was, I think I called that one all but last or something. Was that on one of the practice exams somewhere? Did anybody find it? It's probably on one of the older ones. After a while, exam questions just pile up on your head. But the notion is you'd have an automaton like this, and it's got some states and some transitions and some final states. Again, it doesn't matter much. And what I want to do is I want to get out of the automaton one state early, or one transition early. So the notion is I'll find all the states which are one state before a final state, and that possibly can include a final state. So in this particular case, this guy is one state before a final state because he loops. This guy is one state before a final state, and that one is. So that, that, and that. And what you do in this particular case is you say we'll create lambdas for each of these, and make this a final state, and make these non-final. Notice what happens now. Oh, am I out of, focus? Okay, there. So now notice what happens is, in this particular case, the original automaton in the box acts exactly as it would have, except the only way it can ever stop is get out of that and go to the new final state via lambda. But the only time you can ever do that is when he's in a state that's one character away from an old final state. That is, whenever you're in one of these states that has a lambda transition, you've accepted everything except the last character of some valid string. And you can see no matter what string you were about to accept, I can go and trace the path, go back one state early at the end, and trace the lambda, and I would have that string less the final character. So that construction works along the same idea. I don't mess with the original automaton except to add transitions that allow me to either start early in the earlier example, or stop a bit earlier in the example I'm doing now. So there's an example of another one of how to do instructions, and maybe when we have our various questions about material, we'll have some other questions. So question, yeah. Oh, absolutely. So you reverse it, do an all but first, and then reverse it again? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. In fact, there's one exam, I'll get a hold of myself, that had a very easy or very complex solution. That was the one about set subtraction. I'm pretty sure that one is in there. And yeah, well, we'll get it. Maybe somebody will ask about that, maybe not. But if you do happen to ask about that, there's two solutions for it. One is more tedious, but certainly absolutely correct. And the other is a little bit in a mathematical leisure domain, namely subtraction can be defined in terms of complementation and intersection. And there's a neat little Venn diagram that shows that. And if anybody ever bothers to ask about that, we'll talk about it more. Yeah. Absolutely not. Let me give you a great example. Yesterday, I could have had a set that had exactly two items in it, namely the University of Wisconsin and Duke University. That's a regular set, the situation there. But in this situation, there is no constructor that could have gone ahead and predicted which one was the correct subset. Another example is, remember that bracket issue we had? I can write down that set, which is all sets of left brackets that are followed by right brackets. That is certainly a regular set. There it is. But the thing we wanted where we had balanced brackets is a subset of that, but it's not a computable subset. So the problem is, I can always, as a regular set, give me all possible answers, be it who's going to win the basketball game or not. But finding an effective way to select the correct subset is the hard problem. Okay? Yeah, and in fact, I think in my notes I actually have a point there that this is not true. It's something that sounds plausible, that if I can do the bigger set, I can do the smaller set. No, but it's not. And this thing is certainly a good one. Or think of anything where you think of all possible answers and you have to compute the correct set of answers. And in many cases, not only is it not regular, it's not even computable. Now, if you believe, you know, computers can predict the future, I don't know, but situation. I think the Badgers were 1-point favorites and they still didn't win in situation. But I guess 1-point favorites doesn't mean very much. Certainly didn't last night. So any other questions about the homework? Okay, so what we have two choices now. Let's see how we're doing time-wise. I think we have plenty of time left. Yeah. So I'll open the floor up to questions about old exams, if you want to ask about how this or that would have been done, or just topics. You know, I talked about parsing or scanning or regular expressions or finite automata or LL or LLR or whatever, and anything you'd like me to review in anticipation of tomorrow's exam, which of course most of you won't be attending, but I have to pretend, you know, that situation there, that you know, we'll do it. And maybe next week we'll have another little session and for people who really have to, it's sort of situation there. Yeah, so you...
Mm-hmm. Is there any limit to operations that we can just say within a finite automaton, like perform this operation? Or is it anything that you can kind of represent through a symbol and describe what it means is fine?
The only way I know to do it is if I can subdivide the operation to be on a digit-by-digit basis. It turned out that this thing, remainder, I guess because it had a finite number of remainder, I think I could generalize it, not just divided by 3, but divided by 5 or 7 or anything you wanted. I think it would probably still work. You would just simply have more states representing more various different remainders. But the principle, I think it would work. I can't see why it wouldn't. But if you ask me something like exponentiation or something, that I don't know of. If it's true, I don't know that it is. Yeah, I'd have to ask somebody more mathematically inclined than I. So I tend to doubt it, but I don't know an absolute proof one way or the other. But certainly if it's something where I have to have all the digits. So we have, for example, a couple of questions where it says, is it the case that I have an equal number of A's and an equal number of B's in a set, regular? And the answer is no. because it's the old balanced brackets problem disguised. But equally, you can say that my imbalance, if I'm saying counting number of A's and number of B's, I could think of it as like IOUs. I bought lunch today, you got to buy it tomorrow. And all of a sudden, I bought lunch for 7 days and 8 days and 9 days, and you know who I'm going to lunch with because you're probably the same person you go to lunch with. It's a situation, it's clear that there's no way to kind of incrementally hide that information. I've got to accumulate more and more. He owes me another lunch and another and another. And that would be the basis for me. I believe I could prove that it wasn't. But again, you know, it's subtle, and it's always the case that there might be some very clever way of doing exponentiation, for example, digit by digit. I tend to doubt it, but I don't know for a fact, and I won't claim it. And if anybody's really very mathematical expert, maybe you could tell me. I know a few people here were math majors in their former lives. After all, computer scientists are just mathematicians who get paid well in a situation there. And the math people know that more than... The math people hate computer science people on campus more than just about anybody else. Because the math people know they're smarter than computer scientists, and maybe they are, and they get paid less, and they know that for sure. So they can count. It's not like Einstein where he couldn't balance his checkbook. They could do that much. So here are these nerds who aren't as smart as I am and are getting paid way more. And many of them haven't been even out here. They've been out here and see, oh my gosh, you know, then they jump ship immediately. And maybe some of you have. Maybe some of you were math majors and said, what that world am I doing? Let's go ahead and do something more profitable. Right, right. I can remember what happened is that I don't have to store an arbitrary large value. I just have a remainder. And I believe it's the case digit by digit, I can map the remainders. Remember what happened is when you read another digit in binary, you double the remainder or double it plus one. And if it gets too big, you subtract off the base that you're dividing by to get back to a smaller. So you know, so you're in a finite, in a fixed domain. I think there's something called Galois theory, but I'm not even sure. I've heard the name, but something, you know, where you do mathematics in a fixed number of values, not an infinite number of values. And they had all kinds of cute results, most of which I either never knew or have long since forgotten. But we have mathematicians here to remind us. So, yes?
So you mentioned for number four that every NFA and every DFA has a corresponding regular expression.
Yes. I'd have to get on my notes. I haven't done it in a couple of years, so I could dig out some old notes, but there is an algorithm that maybe I can, for next time, or why don't you just email me if you're interested in, and we'll dig it out. Absolutely. And I can even give you the flavor, but I just don't have all the details, and I hate to lecture without reviewing my notes. But essentially what it amounts to, let me give you a tiny flavor of what it is. It's sort of a situation where automata... are labeled by single characters. So what you do is you tend to try to reduce the number of states by making transitions that have more than one character on them, and in fact have fragments of regular expressions. So for example, this guy, this is one I remember, would be translated to that. And there are ways to do it when you have loops and so on, and they cover all the cases for ORs and so on. And it is doable, and it's either way. Sometimes the algorithm is clean, sometimes it's not. But I don't normally teach it because it's less useful. The other direction is actually used by scanner generators. This thing, but it does exist. And we almost put it in the book, but then my co-author says, nobody cares about that anymore. And except for you, that might be true, but a situation there. In fact, it may be in one of my older versions of the book. I have to see. Do we have a library here with oldies and goodies here? Actually, the book is in its third version. There's two earlier versions. And if it is, I'm just bringing a copy of the book, and you can read it from firsthand. Cool. Other questions? So would you prefer asking questions in anticipation of the exam, or shall we just get right on to class material, which would be type checking? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, so what we'll do there is, that was a question on one of the old exams, right? So what I'll do is I'll get this guy back to life. And you can remind me which exam it was, and I'll just bring it up just so everybody can.
It was question four of the exam in 2012.
Fall of 2012 is what we're talking about. Does that sound right? Yeah, that looks like it all right. And of course, it's going to be on a line break. Cool. Oh, well, that's sorry. Is that easy enough for people to, yeah, I guess it's not too bad. So the question essentially is, how could you do conditional compilation in this particular case? And there are a couple approaches, but one is to simply treat the, basically, let me just remind you, if you haven't done C or something like this, is that you have a pound sign if, and then a zero or a one. This is old C, using zero for false and one for true. So zero or a one. And then some text and a pound sign end, I believe it is. Yeah. And the notion is, you have that in your, so you can include or exclude text from your program. And the notion is, pound sign zero says exclude it, because zero is false. So anything from here to here is ignored. If it's a one, and I guess even anything other than zero, but let's just play zero and one to keep it a tad easier, then this stuff is ignored. So it's an easy way to have a block of code and to activate or to deactivate it. It's an alternative, for example, to putting code in comments, which people have done in the past, but again, because comments don't nest, that's sometimes problematic. And these sort of things, I don't believe conditional comments nest, do they? Does anybody go back to the CPP? Do conditional compilation like that nest? In my question, I'm not expecting an answer that talks about nesting. I don't think it does, and the normal scanning approach wouldn't handle it. So let's assume it doesn't. So one way to do that is to actually make the scanner into sort of a mini scanner slash parser and have it scan this whole gizmo into one of two tokens. So this would be, and remember, this is not all that much different than having something like a comment or a string that has embedded spaces and so on. So you can imagine having a definition that says, find a pound sign if and some number of blanks followed by a zero or a one, and maybe we'll require this to be on a single line, so then a line feed or additional blanks. So kind of like a single line comment, except of course it's not a comment, it's a directive. And similarly, we would just match pound sign end as a fancy token. The reason that would be a cool thing to do is, once you match this, normally what we do is we return a token. But there's no reason why we can't have code activated here that does something that affects scanning. And one of the things you could do to affect scanning is essentially go into what we might call a skip mode. And a skip mode, as the name suggests, means skip the characters. One way to do that, and I'm not sure that it's the way the CPP does it, but it would be certainly convenient in our approach, would be to have our scanner, whenever it's going to return a token, have it go through a subroutine that's sort of a conditional return. So instead of saying just return, you go ahead and call somebody else and it'll do the return for you. I mean, that's certainly doable. We have little blocks of code, but there's nothing that says you can't have methods. You had some methods in there when you, for example, did conversion of digits into an integer or things of that. So you go into this thing and you say, conditionally return this. Based on what? Based on a flag that this sucker sets or clears in this situation. I'm sorry, sets. So if it's if zero, and I guess what? If zero means skip it, right? It says it's false. Yeah. So if it's zero, you put the skip flag on, and anybody from here to here that wants to return a token doesn't. Stuff's been skipped. Now, that assumes that the stuff between here is valid, a text that should be reasonably scanned. I'm not sure the CPP required that, CPP being the C preprocessor, the guy that actually implemented this. But it certainly seems to me a reasonable thing. I mean, a situation where the intention is you'll turn this on and off. And why would you want to turn it on and have garbage that's rejected by the scanner, for example? And what happens is when you hit an end, you're out of skip mode. And of course, if it's it pound sign one, this guy simply does nothing. He throws himself away, and the end does that. You could also, if you wanted to, and I wouldn't require it, have sort of a counting mechanism that says you should have as many pound sign ends as pound sign ifs. You know, he could have a pound sign if that ran away to the end of a program, kind of like a runaway comment, but a runaway conditional compilation. So that's the sort of solution you'd have. Another alternative would simply be to have, when you're in skip mode, go ahead and go to an alternative reading mechanism that does sort of a mini scan that looks for absolutely nothing except pound sign N. And everything else, no, throw away, pound sign N, out of it and back to normal scanning. So that's sort of the notion. So the notion is the scanner can be your, scanner generator can be your friend, create new tokens that aren't tokens the program sees, but rather are things that allow you to do the scanning process more readily. That's what I had in mind as an excellent answer. There's all kinds of variations, but that would be a good one. Is anybody still confused about what I was getting at? I see a couple of... You're saying, do you really believe that I was going to answer that one? But remember, you have your choice. I mean, a couple of people are amazed that actually you have your choice. You can skip some questions. So I don't recommend it, but if something, scanning or parsing or whatever thing, really eludes you, you can, you know, take the situation and say, I'm not going to answer any parsing question, come what may. And, of course, I'm going to ask the world's easiest parsing question then. But, I mean, you can do that. So you can try to game the system or whatever. Yes? Really, yeah, and a couple of people have had that. And when they did that, I almost let them get away. But here's the problem with this. Something like that. I'm sorry. Suppose the pound sign N were in a quoted string or a comment or something. Which coder takes precedence? Does it say we skip everything up to here or the comment or whatever? But it's not a half-bad answer. You've got to be really careful about these boundary conditions, is all. I think perhaps something like a quoted string would even be worse. But, you know, if we came up with a definition of which took precedence, was it a case that we skip tokens or do we skip characters? The CPP really skipped characters, and you could do some god-awful things with that. For example, you could have part of one token created by one entity and part of another. I mean, we had a question, I think it's on one of the old exams, where you did a pound sign define and you give a name to a string. Well, in the old CPP, you could actually have a couple of strings which expanded to part of a valid token. So you could have one that does a prefix like hi and another one that does a prefix like mom. And they expand to fractions of tokens. That was in there because the CPP was done in advance of C, and actually it could be used with other languages. I think that's a terrible definition. I think any definition like this ought to probably be done in terms of not skipping characters, but skipping tokens. Since in the language, characters don't exist, tokens exist, and they're the basic verbiage of the program. So if that were the case, you're probably fine on what you're doing in that particular case. But that sort of thing. So that's the only gotcha I remember on that one. But it's not a bad idea at all, and I think it's close to work, and you could probably engineer it into something suitable. See another hand up? Yeah. Right. Absolutely. You did that, it's even better. And I'm sure, you know, in everyday work, you come up with great solutions, but gosh, this or that or the other thing may just backfire. And it's always a difficulty of that. What do you do with something that's a great solution if only the problem were a little different? And that's part of the computing business and all that. Sometimes you have to change the rules, sometimes not. But, I mean, yeah, that's really good because, you know, it shows that you're on top of it. And I certainly don't want to see details. I want to see something where you say, yes, I know how to create token definitions, for example, and because they have Java code is activated when they're matched, I could set flags. If I set flags, I could do things like go into skip mode and so on. Skip mode could be either be done by not returning tokens or by not passing characters, depending on whether I wanted to do it at the character level or token level. So, yeah, that'd be a fine answer. I'm just talking about that, and this thing doesn't talk about it, so I probably would not hold you to that. But what you'd have to end up doing probably is have an error token. What you would happen is, if you got to, what's the error token? So can we do any processing? You have to have some processing at the, oops. You have to do some processing at the end of a program. It's equivalent to having a slash star and not having the star slash eventually match it. So you'd have to have some special error handling for that. But in this particular case, you know, you could tap dance around it, actually. You could say a pound sign end is implicit in the end the file marker. And that really wouldn't hurt you because the pound sign end simply says turn off whatever I'm doing. But end the file does that anyway. So all you got to do is say this is a problem, but it's not a problem because I'm bright enough to realize that that it's not going to hurt. And it really wouldn't. I mean, situation if you, when you get to the end of that, it's either all totally skipped or it was totally processed. Yeah, that's fine. That's exactly what the intent of the conditional compilation was. So that was a little dinger there. So why don't we take a break for about 15 minutes, and what we'll do is we'll either resume with questions on the material, or we'll get into the next topic. And for people who came in late, I have graded material. Yeah, just a minute. Let me turn this off.